Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're digging into something really crucial for anyone involved in modern software development, the 2025 Platform Engineering Pulse Report. We're going to break it down for you.
Yeah, it's a key topic. Platform engineering, or PE as you'll hear it called, it's everywhere now.
It really is. And this report, it's our guide. We want to get past the buzzwords and look at what's actually happening on the ground.
Right, because there's often a gap, isn't there, between the theory, what people say PE should be, and the reality in big companies.
Exactly. So this report benchmarks that reality. It looks at why companies are really adopting platforms, what features they're actually building, and crucially, how effective those strategies are proving to be.
And that's our mission today, really, to give you, the listener, a solid understanding of this landscape. Think of the report as a roadmap.
A roadmap based on data, not just ideas.
Precisely. It lets us check those theories against what's happening in the industry, large scale. So you can make decisions based on evidence, not just, vendor hype or what you read online.
Okay, good. So if you're building a platform, or even just thinking about it, this is the kind of insight you need.
Definitely. It helps guide that maturity journey.
All right, before we jump into some of those maybe surprising findings, let's just level set. What exactly is platform engineering? Because honestly, I hear different takes depending on who I talk to.
That's fair. The definition can seem a bit fluid. But at its core, platform engineering is about designing, building, and importantly, maintaining a set of capabilities.
Capabilities for who?
For developers, to help them create, deploy, and run their applications much more efficiently and securely. It's about supporting that whole software development lifecycle, the SDLC.
And it's usually delivered as code, right? Infrastructure as code.
Often, yes. But it's more than just the tools. It's the mindset. The main goal, the strategy behind it, is to shift the developer's focus.
Shift it away from.
Away from managing all the underlying complexity, infrastructure, networking details, security policies, those complex deployment pipelines. We want developers focused on writing business features, on innovation.
Not wrestling with YAML files all day.
Exactly. When PE is done well, it speeds things up, improves quality, improves the security posture. It makes a real difference.
And there's this theoretical ideal, right? A consensus in the community about what makes for a successful platform effort. It sounds great on paper.
It does sound great. And the consensus usually highlights four key things. First, treat the platform like a product. It has users, features. It needs to deliver ongoing value.
Okay. Platform as a product. Makes sense.
Second, treat developers as your customers. You need their feedback. Good documentation, ways to measure their satisfaction.
Right, customer focus. What else?
Third, the platform needs to be self-service. Developers shouldn't have to file a ticket and wait days for something simple. Minimize that friction.
Self-service, got it. And the last one.
And this is maybe the most important. Solve real developer problems. Don't just build something because it's the cool new tech. Find the actual pain points where developers are stuck or wasting time. And build solutions for those specific needs.
So identify the friction and remove it.
Precisely. And, the reason this Pulse report was needed was because we had these great theories, product thinking, developer focus, but not much hard data on whether companies were actually doing it that way, or if success was driven by something else entirely.
Okay, and this is where, as you said, it gets really interesting, the adoption drivers.
Yeah.
Because the report points to this pretty significant contradiction, maybe even a tension.
Yeah, a major tension between what the literature, the thought leaders say should drive PE adoption and what organizations are actually citing as their top reasons when they, ask for the budget.
So the common theory, you hear it a lot from places like the CNCF, is that the main goal is reducing developer cognitive load, making life easier for developers, preventing burnout, improving morale. All focus on the developer experience or DevEx.
That's the ideal, yes, the developer-centric view. But the reality check in this report, it's pretty stark, maybe a bit sobering.
How so?
Those developer-focused reasons, reducing cognitive load, fixing burnout, they were very rarely in the top three reasons companies gave for starting a platform initiative.
Really? Not even in the top three?
Rarely. They might be mentioned as like a secondary benefit, but they weren't the primary justifications used to get the project funded.
So what was driving it then, if not DevEx?
It was much more about hard organizational and operational priorities, things that resonate higher up the chain, perhaps.
Like what specifically?
The top drivers that came out in the report were overwhelmingly focused on organizational efficiency and control. Number one. Efficiency improvements, just broadly across software delivery.
Okay, general efficiency.
Number two, standardizing processes, getting everyone using the same tools, the same workflows, less variation.
Standardization makes sense from a management perspective.
Number three, increasing productivity, getting more output, more features shipped with the existing engineering teams.
Doing more with less, essentially.
Kind of, yeah. And number four, automation, reducing manual work, reducing toil. Things like increasing security compliance and standardizing tooling also ranked very high. It really confirms that the focus driving these big initiatives is often institutional.
Well, wait a second. If you improve efficiency, if you standardize and automate things, mm-hmm. doesn't that also reduce developer toil? Doesn't it indirectly help with cognitive load? If I don't have to manually configure a pipeline, isn't my experience better?
That's a great point. And yes, absolutely, there's a connection. Those things do indirectly lower cognitive load.
So is it a genuine misalignment, or is DevEx just the nicer, more developer-friendly way to frame these top-down standardization and efficiency pushes that management wanted anyway?
I think you've hit on something really important there. The data strongly suggests it's more of an alignment issue between the proclaimed mission, we're helping the developer, and the actual business motivation. We need to optimize the machine, cut costs, ensure compliance.
So the DevEx benefit is real, but it might be a happy side effect rather than the main reason the check got signed.
That seems to be what the data implies, yes. For the people controlling the budgets, the CIOs, the business leaders, the arguments around standardization, efficiency gains, cost reduction, compliance, those often carry more weight.
It's easier to sell, this will cut ops costs by 15% and help us pass audits, than this will make our developers happier.
Exactly. It's a perhaps uncomfortable truth, but it's crucial for anyone trying to get a platform initiative off the ground. You likely need to lead with those organizational metrics, those efficiency and standardization arguments to secure the funding. The DevEx improvements can and should absolutely follow, but they might not be the primary lever to get the initial green light.
That's a really vital insight into the internal politics, isn't it? Okay, let's switch gears. If companies are building these platforms, these internal developer platforms or IDPs, what are they actually putting in them? What features are prioritized?
Yeah, what's in the toolkit?
We need to get into the weeds a bit on the top 10 features the report identified. We already touched on why some are essential, like deployment automation. You need that to reduce risk and stress, especially at scale.
Absolutely.
And infrastructure automation, you mentioned configuration drift. That slow creep of manual changes is deadly. Infrastructure automation stops that, replaces tedious click ops.
Totally agree. Those are foundational. If your platform doesn't nail those, it loses credibility fast. Okay, let's walk through the top 10 because the details show the sheer scope these platform teams are often handling.
All right, number one.
One, builds. Simple sounding, compiling, linking, bundling code. But the platform's job here isn't just doing it, it's doing it fast.
Because a slow build kills developer flow.
Completely. The platform needs to provide things like smart caching, maybe distributed builds, parallel processing, whatever it takes to get that feedback loop down to minutes, not, you know, half an hour.
Okay, fast builds. Next. Yeah.
Two, deployment automation. This is way beyond just copying files. It's handling complex rollouts, blue-green canaries, handling configuration changes smoothly, database migrations reliably. The platform handles all that choreography.
Abstracting the complexity.
Exactly. Developer just says deploy. All right, three. Infrastructure automation. We talked about drift. This is where tools like Terraform, Pulumi, Crossplane come in. Everything defined as code, automatically enforced.
Which enables things like temporary test environments too, right?
Precisely. Ephemeral environments.
Yeah.
And rapid, reliable disaster recovery. Essential. Number four, test automation.
Running tests automatically in the pipeline.
Yes. Functional tests, security scans like SAST and DAST, performance tests. The key is integrating it tightly so developers get feedback fast, ideally within minutes. This massively reduces burnout because bugs are caught by the person who just wrote the code.
Instead of weeks later in QA.
Right. Okay, five, monitoring and observability, or O11Y. This is more than just CPU charts. We're talking distributed tracing, understanding request flows across services, measuring things from the customer's perspective.
Seeing the whole picture.
Yeah, understanding the impact of issues. The platform needs to provide this cohesively so you don't have 50 different monitoring tools developers have to set up themselves.
Okay. Halfway there, number six.
Six, documentation, often overlooked, but critical. It needs to be treated like a feature. Clear, updated, owned, Maybe the platform even helps automate it, like extracting API docs.
Making it discoverable and trustworthy.
Exactly. 7, security scanning. Shifting security left. Automated vulnerability scans, dependency checks, running inside the pipeline. Feedback is immediate, right back to the developer.
So security isn't just a gate at the end.
Correct. It complements, not replaces, deeper reviews, but it catches things early. 8, one-click setup for new projects. This is a huge DevEx win.
Automating the boilerplate.
All of it. Repo setup, applying security templates, initial CI/CD pipeline config, maybe even basic service scaffolding. Ensures consistency, security baselines, and gets developers to writing meaningful code way faster.
Cuts down that time to first commit drastically.
Absolutely. 9, artifact management. Making sure that the thing you built and tested, the container image, the JAR file, is stored reliably and is the single source of truth for that version.
Do you deploy the right thing every time?
Yes. Tools like Artifactory or Nexus are common here, prevents deploying the wrong version. And finally, 10, secrets management. Central place for database passwords, API keys, all that sensitive stuff.
Like HashiCorp Vault or cloud provider service.
Exactly, critical for security. And imagine rotating a compromised secret, doing it centrally, versus updating config files across dozens, maybe hundreds of services manually. It prevents that massive ripple effect.
Wow, okay, that's a lot. That's a huge amount of responsibility for one team or area.
It really is.
Which brings up the question of ownership. We hear about platform engineering teams, but also dedicated DevEx teams. Is there overlap? A turf war? Who owns what?
The data suggests there's definitely overlap, but generally the platform team tends to have the broader scope, especially managing that core infrastructure layer.
So platform handles the lower level stuff more?
Often, yeah. Things like builds, deployment, test automation, those are frequently shared responsibilities, which makes sense because they directly impact the developer experience, which is core to both charters.
But are there things that are clearly one or the other?
The report did highlight some distinct zones. Things seen as purely platform only were deep infrastructure concerns. Certificate management, managing DNS records, core networking controls.
Okay, the real plumbing.
Right. And conversely, the main thing listed as purely DevEx only was more about enablement, developer training, and education.
Interesting. So DevEx is more about the soft side, the human element.
It leans that way in this data, yeah. But the main takeaway here isn't about drawing hard lines. It's about alignment.
How so?
If your organization does split platform engineering, building the tools from DevEx, improving the experience of using the tools, they absolutely must be tightly coupled, working off the same roadmap, same priorities.
Otherwise, they spend all their time arguing about who owns what.
Exactly. If they operate in silos, negotiating boundaries and ownership will just eat up energy and limit the impact they could have together. They need a unified vision for serving the developer.
That makes sense. And thinking about building these features, this unified vision, it brings us naturally to maturity, doesn't it? Are teams trying to build all 10 features at once? Or is there a more phased approach?
Definitely phased. You don't boil the ocean on day one. The report identifies a pretty clear 3-stage evolution for how these IDP capabilities typically layer up over time.
Okay, stage one, what's the foundation?
Stage one is all about the deployment pipeline, just getting code reliably and repeatedly into production. That's the absolute baseline.
So which features does that include?
The core ones. Builds, test automation, basic level probably, artifact management, deployment automation, and some essential monitoring observability. If you can't ship code reliably, nothing else matters.
Right, gotta walk before you run. What's stage two?
Stage two is the secure pipeline. Once the basic flow works, the focus shifts to integrating security much earlier and more deeply.
Shifting left.
Exactly. So you take the stage one features and add security scanning within the pipeline and robust secrets management. This stage can be challenging, actually.
Why is that?
Because integrating security tools properly often adds new steps, maybe some friction. Developers might need to change how they work, fix vulnerabilities earlier. It requires adjustment.
Okay, so stage one is flow. Stage two is securing that flow. What's stage three?
Stage three is the full DevOps pipeline. This is where you get the full lifecycle capabilities, really mature platform features.
The bells and whistles.
More than that, the things that make the experience truly smooth. This is where you add sophisticated documentation systems, that one-click setup for new projects, and comprehensive infrastructure automation.
Huh. It's interesting that infrastructure automation and one-click setup, which seem like huge productivity boosters, come so late in stage three. Why wait?
It's usually because they depend heavily on the stability and standardization built in stages one and two. You can't reliably automate infrastructure provisioning if your build or deployment processes are flaky or insecure.
Okay, dependencies.
And that one-click setup. It relies on having well-defined, documented, and automated processes for everything that came before it. Also, remember the point about documentation. The report stressed high-quality documentation over just comprehensive documentation.
Right. Clear ownership, kept up to date.
Exactly. That quality documentation enables the Stage 3 features. It supports the automation.
Mm-hmm.
Stage 3 is where the platform really starts to feel like a cohesive, polished product that automates away the baseline complexity for the developer.
Okay, that progression makes a lot of sense. Stage 1, ship.
Yeah.
Stage 2, ship securely. Stage 3. Ship securely and effortlessly.
That's a great way to put it.
So connecting this back to those initial drivers' efficiency, standardization. How do organizations know if this multi-stage, multi-year effort is actually working? How are they measuring success?
ROI.
Measurement. This is where things get, well, a bit messy sometimes.
Messy how? The first thing that jumped out at me from the report was that almost a quarter, 23% of organizations aren't using formal metrics at all. They're relying on subjective assessments. Gut feel.
Yeah, that 23% is concerning.
Oh.
It puts a pretty big question mark over some of the overall success claims, doesn't it? If nearly one in four are just kind of guessing if it's working.
It really does. But okay, for the three quarters we're measuring, what are they looking at? The report mentioned they track between one and eight different metrics.
Right. And those metrics tend to fall into three broad buckets.
Hmm.
Software delivery performance, operational performance, and importantly, user experience. So they're trying to get a multifaceted view.
Let's talk about software delivery. DORA metrics are the standard there, right? Deployment frequency, lead time, change failure rate, time to restore. They are the standard, yes. But the report found their usage is really uneven. Deployment frequency is the most popular. By far, 20% use it. Probably because it's the easiest to count, you know. How many times did we deploy this week?
Okay, easy to measure. But what about the others? The ones that tell you about stability and speed?
That's where it drops off. Change failure rate is only used by 13%. Time to restore service, 10%. And change lead time, the time from code commit to production, that's only tracked by a tiny 3%.
Only 3% for lead time? That seems like a really critical measure of efficiency. Why so low?
It's likely because it's the hardest one to measure accurately, especially in big, complex companies. It requires really solid end-to-end automation and traceability, which, connecting back, many only achieve in stage three maturity.
Ah, right. If you don't have that one-click setup and fully automated pipeline, tracking lead time precisely is probably a manual nightmare.
Exactly. And relying only on DORA can be a bit misleading, too. Building out the platform itself might temporarily slow down application teams, so you need more nuanced metrics.
Which brings us to the MONK metrics, designed specifically for platforms.
Correct. MONK tries to capture that platform as a product aspect. It includes specific measures, but also this abstract category to link back to those big organizational goals we talked about earlier.
Okay, what are the MONK specifics?
Well, first, there are key customer metrics used by about 10%. These are custom defined by the organization itself. They reflect those specific business drivers. Maybe it's reduced security incidents by X percent or lower average compute cost per service, unique to them.
Tied back to the original why.
Exactly. Then, really important for the developers as customers' idea is Net Promoter Score, NPS, used by about 5%, gauging developer satisfaction and loyalty.
How likely are developers to recommend the platform to a colleague?
That's the idea. But here's a critical point of confusion the report found. NPS isn't just the 110 rating. It's a specific calculation. Percentage of promoters, scored 910, minus the percentage of detractors, scored 06. The result is a score from Linux 100 to plus 100.
Not just the average score.
Right. But many organizations were apparently reporting their average rating, like our NPS is 8, instead of the actual calculated NPS score. That's a big mistake, because you lose the insight into the distribution how many love it versus how many hate it. You need the real score.
That's a really crucial clarification. Confusing the rating and the score gives you a completely misleading picture of satisfaction. Okay, what else is in MONK?
There's market share, tracked by about 3.4%. This is basically asking, of all the teams who could use our platform because we support their tech stack, what percentage actually are using it?
A measure of internal product market fit.
Exactly. And finally, onboarding time, also around 3.4%. How long does it take a new developer or someone starting a new project to get their very first code change successfully into production using the platform?
a direct measure of the platform's efficiency and maybe its documentation quality.
Absolutely. If it takes weeks to get started, something's wrong with the automation or the guidance.
And what did the data show for typical onboarding time?
The majority, 53%, were somewhere between 1 week and 1 month, which honestly still feels quite long.
A whole week or more just to get set up.
Yeah. But the good news is over a third of the high-performing orgs got that time down to less than a week. So it is possible to make that initial experience much smoother with good automation and docs.
Okay, let's double-click on market share. That metric forces a really important strategic question, doesn't it? If you build it and they don't come,
right,
what do you do? If developers can use the platform but choose not to.
Right. How do you win them over or figure out why they're staying away? Market share analysis helps the platform team decide where to focus their efforts. The report used this idea of a coverage adoption chart. Imagine a diagonal line.
Okay.
If your platform falls below that line, it means you have high potential coverage. You support the tech stacks people are using, like Java, Python, Go, but low actual adoption. People could use it, but aren't.
So what's the strategy then?
Your focus has to be entirely on understanding the why not. Improving the developer experience. Is the onboarding painful? Is the documentation unclear? Do developers not see the benefits? You need to basically market the platform internally, demonstrate value, remove friction. It's a DevEx problem.
Okay, that's strategy one. Fix the experience. What's the other scenario?
Strategy two is when you're on or hitting the ceiling of that diagonal line. You've captured most of the developers using the tech stacks you currently support. Your market share is high for your existing coverage.
So you've won over the current eligible audience.
Exactly. Now, if you want to grow adoption further, your focus shifts. It's less about improving the experience for existing stacks and more about increasing your coverage, adding support for new technology stacks that the business strategically needs.
Supporting maybe a new language or framework that's becoming important.
Right. But, and this is a really important But you should only add support for strategic new technologies. Technologies the organization wants to move towards.
Not just anything developers ask for.
Definitely not. A common trap is platform teams feeling pressured to add support for older, maybe even obsolete tech stacks just because some teams are still using them.
Why is that bad?
Because by making it easy to use those old stacks on the platform, you inadvertently encourage their continued use. You make it easier to stick with the past. It pulls resources away from optimizing the strategic stacks and holds the whole organization back. You need to be opinionated about the future.
That's a subtle but powerful point. Don't let the platform enable bad habits.
Yeah.
Okay, zooming out again. The overall picture seemed positive. 60% of platforms meeting many or all goals. That sounds pretty good.
It is encouraging, yeah.
But what separates that 60% from the 40% who are struggling? If two companies start building a platform, what makes one a high performer and the other not?
Well, the most obvious correlation was just the number of features. More features generally meant more success.
How much more?
Platforms that met all their goals had, on average, 6.0 features implemented. Those that met none of their goals averaged only 2.0 features. So yeah, breadth seems to matter.
Okay, so just build more stuff.
Ah, but that's where the nuance comes in. Because the report also found that platforms could be highly successful with as few as 3 features.
So it's not just the quantity.
Exactly. It comes back to that product mindset we talked about. Are the features you do have solving the right problems, the biggest pain points for your developers? Or are you just building features because you think you should, that we know best anti-pattern?
So success is more about relevance than sheer volume.
Precisely. A platform with 3 features that nail the top 3 developer frustrations is going to be far more successful than one with 10 features that only solve minor issues, or worse, introduce new friction. Focus on impact.
Did the report show which features high performers tended to focus on? Are some bets safer than others?
Yes, absolutely. It wasn't just any random set of features. High performers consistently prioritized practices that made the core CI/CD pipeline more robust and reliable, especially complementing the basic build step.
Like what specifically?
Compared to low performers, high performers were 3.6 times more likely to have strong test automation, 3.3 times more likely to do artifact management properly, 2.2 times more likely to have good monitoring and observability, and 2.0 times more likely to offer that one-click setup for new projects.
Interesting. So after builds, the focus is heavily on testing, artifact control, observability, and smoothing the onboarding, making the core pipeline trustworthy and easy to use.
That's what the data strongly suggests, yes. Those seem to be the features that provide the most leverage for success early on: predictability and ease of use.
Now, another factor that often impacts big projects is time. Sometimes time kills initiatives, but here it seems like time is actually your friend.
It absolutely is. In fact, the single biggest variable correlating with success in the report was simply the age of the platform initiative.
Older platforms do better.
Significantly better. These things take time. They require sustained investment. The report found that platforms operating for 3 years or more had a very impressive 71% success rate, meeting many or all goals.
3 years plus. That's a commitment.
It is, and it ties into this pattern called the J curve, which is common in big transformations.
The J curve. What's that?
You get an initial surge of progress, the easy wins, the low-hanging fruit, that's the start of the J. But then, inevitably, you hit a dip. Performance might temporarily decrease.
A dip, why?
Usually happens in years 2 through 5. Teams start hitting harder problems, integrating complex legacy systems, dealing with organizational resistance, maybe technical debt catches up, people slip back into old habits. It gets harder before it gets better again.
So things get worse before they really take off.
Often, yes, that's the bottom of the J. The key is that organizations need to expect this dip. Communicate that it's normal, part of the maturation process, not a sign of failure. If you panic and pull funding during the dip, you never get to the upward swing of the J, where the real compounding benefits kick in, typically after that 3-year mark.
That's crucial for managing expectations. Expect the dip, plan for it, survive it.
Exactly. Patience and persistence are key.
Okay, let's go back to that strategy conflict we mentioned earlier, optional versus mandatory adoption. The theory, the ideal, is build something so good developers choose it. Win them over.
Right, the market share approach. Treat it like a real product competing for users.
But what did the data say about mandatory platforms?
Here's the big contradiction. Despite all the talk about optional adoption, the report found that 63%, nearly two-thirds of the successful platforms, were actually mandated.
Wow. So mandatory works better in practice.
It seems to correlate strongly with higher success rates and better budget security.
Why would that be? Why would forcing people to use it lead to better outcomes?
There are a few theories. One is that mandatory adoption forces the organization, including the application teams, to actually invest the time and effort needed to make the platform work well for them. They can't just ignore it, so they contribute feedback, help iron out kinks, which ultimately improves the platform for everyone.
So it forces collaboration and optimization.
Possibly. Another key factor is alignment with other mandatory things, especially security and compliance.
Ah, okay. Explain that.
Many organizations have mandatory security policies or compliance requirements. If the platform is the only approved way or the easiest way to meet those mandatory policies, then adopting the platform becomes the path of least resistance for developers.
So you mandate the policy, and the platform becomes the easy button for complying with that policy.
Exactly. It's a strategic way to drive adoption that satisfies both the organization's need for control and standardization, and the developer's desire to not have to figure out complex compliance rules themselves. The platform solves it for them.
That makes a lot of sense. But if platforms are often mandatory, how does that affect how people feel about them?
Yeah.
You mentioned developers as customers. What about their perspective on these mandatory systems?
This leads directly to what the report called the perception gap, and it's significant.
Okay, what's the gap?
When asked about platform success, the platform engineers building it, reported a 75% success rate, meeting many or all goals. Pretty high.
They feel good about their work.
Understandably. But the consumers, the application developers actually using the platform, they reported only a 56% success rate.
Wow, 75%. Versus 56%. That's almost a 20-point difference.
It's huge. This producer bias is a real risk. The platform team sees developers using the system, because they have to, and assumes everything's great. They might be confusing compliance with actual success or satisfaction.
Developers might be using it, but hating the experience and finding painful workarounds.
Precisely. And the platform team, looking at adoption numbers, might be completely unaware of that friction.
But does this mandatory approach, even with the perception gap, help keep the lights on?
It seems to. The data showed that mandatory platforms were almost 2.5 times more likely to have guaranteed budget safety for the next 5 years.
2.5 times.
Yeah. It strongly suggests that aligning with those core organizational drivers, efficiency, standardization, compliance, even if it means mandating usage, is incredibly effective at securing long-term funding and ensuring the platform survives that J curve. The business sees the value in the control it provides.
So the mandate ensures survival and funding, but maybe at the cost of developer happiness, at least initially.
That appears to be the trade-off sometimes, yes, which makes measuring beyond just compliance even more critical.
Right. So if that perception gap is real, and if relying only on adoption metrics when it's mandatory is misleading, creating that zero metric success illusion you mentioned, how important is tracking those user satisfaction metrics, and how often are teams actually checking in?
Tracking is absolutely non-negotiable if you want real success, not just compliance. The report was clear. Organizations tracking more metrics were significantly more likely to meet their goals.
So data matters.
Data definitely matters. That zero metric success illusion is where a team stops getting support tickets or complaints and thinks, great, it's working. But in reality, developers have just given up asking for help and have built complex, inefficient workarounds because the platform is too painful. Silence is not success.
Okay, so track metrics, but which ones and how often?
Variety is good, as we discussed technical metrics like DORA, operational metrics, and user satisfaction like NPS or onboarding time. But frequency seems just as important as variety.
How frequent?
Most teams reported getting feedback weekly or monthly, which seems like a healthy cadence. But the report had a very stark warning.
Oh.
It basically said that getting feedback less often, meaning only quarterly, or even never essentially guarantees a low-performing platform.
Guarantees failure.
Guarantees low performance, yes. You simply cannot improve continuously if you don't have a continuous feedback loop. If you're treating developers as customers, you need to be talking to them, surveying them, observing them regularly, not just once a year.
Continuous feedback for continuous improvement makes perfect sense.
Okay.
We've covered a lot of ground from this report. Let's try to distill it. What does this all mean for you, the listener, if you're adopting a platform or trying to make your existing one better?
I think there are three really key takeaways, practical advice drawn from all this data.
Okay, number one.
Patience and navigation. First, understand and expect the J-curve. This is a multi-year journey. You need to secure sustained funding, ideally for 3+ years. And crucially, communicate proactively about that expected dip in years 2 to 5. Frame it as normal maturation, not failure, to keep stakeholders bought in.
Manage expectations, secure long-term support. Got it. Number two.
Metrics diversity is paramount. Don't rely on just one type of metric. You absolutely need a blend. Technical performance like DORA is important, but you must pair it with user satisfaction metrics like NPS, the real score, and onboarding time, and maybe those custom key customer metrics. Relying only on technical or adoption stats, especially if it's mandatory, invites that producer bias and risks optimizing for the wrong things.
Get the full picture. Technical health and user value.
Okay. And number three, communication and transparency. Be really clear about the platform's goals and strategy. Is it mandatory for compliance? Optional for efficiency? Manage that perception gap actively by sharing both producer and consumer perspectives. And use tools, maybe like the CNCF Platform Maturity Model Assessment, to create a shared understanding and language for planning improvements across adoption, interfaces, operations, and measurement. It helps bridge the gap.
Patience, diverse metrics, and open communication. Sounds like solid advice for any major initiative, really.
It often comes back to the fundamentals, doesn't it?
It really does. Okay, let's wrap this up with a final thought for you, our listener, to chew on. The data we've discussed today paints a clear picture. Mandatory platform adoption aligns very effectively with core organizational goals like efficiency and compliance, and it significantly boosts budget security, helping platforms survive that tricky J-curve. It serves the business well, ensures standardization.
That's what the numbers show.
But it often creates that significant perception gap, potentially sacrificing genuine developer satisfaction, at least in the short term. So here's the challenge for you. How can your organization navigate this? How can you leverage the benefits of a mandated approach securing the budget, driving compliance via the path of least resistance, while still rigorously applying those product-centric principles and metrics, like true NPS, market share analysis, and onboarding time, to ensure that the platform doesn't just enforce compliance, but actually delivers real, tangible value that your internal customers, the developers, genuinely feel and appreciate? How do you make mandatory also mean desirable? That's your knowledge nugget for the week.